The irony of me trying to understand technology in a session about technology here. So there's probably an object lesson that I'll get to eventually by the time we're finished that I didn't anticipate. Thanks for coming. I want to make sure you know I'm not Dave Clayton or Leonard Allen. They're next door. So you won't hurt my feelings if you are thinking you're in the wrong session. I appreciate you coming here. My friend David Baird, former dean here, we were talking last night, and he says, the good news of this is it's easy to find this room when you're wandering around lost. So maybe people who can't get in next door will come in and join our session, and we'll just extend it to, we'll extend the hand of fellowship to anyone who comes in late as they make their way in. I should introduce myself, I guess. In a room this size, we could all introduce everyone, but I won't make you do that. My name's Al Sturgeon, and if you happen to be looking through the document of the speakers and where they're from, it still cracks me up because it says Al Sturgeon, Malibu, California. And I know I look like a celebrity, I'm sure, but it just cracks me up to see that next to my name. You may guess that I work at Pepperdine. Most of the people there that says Malibu, California are obviously Pepperdine employees. I'm originally from Arkansas, and in a setting like this, I never know. Well, in the Churches of Christ, I'm sure somebody's connected to Arkansas somehow or the other. Grew up there, and we probably have stories to tell with each other. And then Mississippi was the next stop for me and my wife. And we were there for 10 years where I served as a preaching minister at the Ocean Springs Church of Christ down on the Gulf Coast. How many of you heard Ruby Bridges last night? I really enjoyed getting to hear her. The only thing I think I have in common with Ruby is we were on the Mississippi Gulf Coast during Hurricane Katrina. And so when she talked about losing her home, that's the one thing I know I can connect with her in. And I got to meet amazing people from the churches throughout the United States. And this is not my topic, so I'm going totally off script here, but the one thing, if you want to say good or bad things about the Churches of Christ and their heritage, the lack of hierarchy is really helpful in a hurricane. I learned that the hard way, but the good way too, is whenever we lost everything in our church and everyone was in ruins, and we finally found a way to get connected to technology, ironically, and send out the call for help. People said, what do you need? And we said, here's what we need. And they said, we're on the way, right? That area is a predominantly Roman Catholic area, and a lot of our friends there were saying it was taking forever for their relief efforts to get to them. They have amazing social work efforts, but just the hierarchy of committee meetings and board meetings and how are we going to distribute all this. Churches of Christ is like, give us a call and we're on the way with a pickup truck, right? And we had a great opportunity living there. Moved here about 8 years ago now for law school, and I've ended up working at the law school now in an administrative capacity. I've been the dean of students for the past 4 years and now moving into a new program. And while I've got a captive audience, I'm going to be working a lot with our Strauss Institute for Dispute Resolution. And I can't miss an opportunity to let you know that it's a leader, considered a leader around the world in solving conflicts and being a peacemaker. So I know churches never have conflicts, but I just want you to know me as a contact in the future if you're ever thinking that there may be ways that that we can help serve you. We want you to be aware of that. I should also say, last introduction here, is that we're in finals right now. The way the Bible lectures work is when the undergraduate campus that you're on primarily finishes classes and all of the students get out of the dorms, then it's a perfect time to have Bible lectures and bring everyone in. Well, the law school doesn't get out at the same time. So we're in the middle of final exams, and I am sneaking away to be down here while they're stressed just up the hill and trying to make it through this difficult time. But we're glad you're here. It's been a blessing for us to be here. My first introduction to Pepperdine was the Pepperdine Bible lectures when I was a preacher and came out. And so I still have that feeling like you have when it's your first time to show up here on campus. Well, if you have a Bible and want to follow along, if not, it's fine. I'm going to be mostly talking about it. The Gospel of Matthew is our text. So if you want to be there, and if you're wondering which chapter to be in, I've got plenty of time to cover all 28 chapters, so we're just going to surf through Matthew, but I am going to focus on chapter 4 in particular. There's Matthew's my favorite book in the Bible. I have this picture that the people that composed the New Testament canon were like college football fans, and they put the best ones at the first, and that tells you what I think about Revelation at the end. It's not my favorite book, but Matthew's my favorite. I think that they started off with the good stuff. And it's been something that's been interesting to me. I did a lot of preaching from Matthew when I was a preacher, and I just finished. My wife and I, in our home, we have a Bible class for graduate students, mostly law students, every Sunday morning on campus here. And we've spent 2 years working through Matthew. I've got 35 minutes now, probably, to do it, but that's okay. Let me give you a little bit of an outline. First of all, Luke Timothy Johnson, if any of you have read some of his work, refers to the different Gospels. He says one way to imagine the Gospels are as portraits. Okay. Someone like me could ask, why didn't God just write a definitive biography of Jesus, right? So we have one that we know this is exactly what happened, everything we need to know, but we have these four different accounts, right? And theologian Luke Timothy Johnson says it's sort of like a portrait, right? If you are like every other family in the world, you probably have more than one picture of yourself, more than one picture of your family, more than one picture of your child. If you happen to have a new grandchild, my understanding is that you take thousands every single day of that same kid. It's the same kid, right? Why do you keep taking pictures? Well, it shows different aspects of that person. So, which is why Johnson talks about the Gospels. It's four different ways of looking at Jesus. Not diametrically opposed, but just from a different angle. We see things in different ways. They have different perspectives. John Wilson, who's one of our retired religion faculty members here, also a dean of Seaver College along the way, gave me a picture of what those four are like, if you're interested. And he says that Matthew is like a formal portrait. Imagine someone retires, or maybe you go to D.C. and you're walking through the Supreme Court or the White House, and you see all of these formal portraits of these leaders along the way. Matthew, he says, is more like that formal portrait. Mark, he says, is much more like a series of snapshots. Yeah, I compare this to when my daughters were teenagers, right? And I would call it more a collage on their bedroom wall, right? Of whoever they were in love with at the time and going through People magazine and all of these people that they put together. But Mark is like this, here's a picture of Jesus, here's a picture of Jesus, here's a picture of Jesus. It's a little choppy as you go through, but it shows all these different scenes together. Luke, John says, is more like a moving picture, to use an old phrase. A movie, a documentary, right? That flows from one thing to the other. And then John, the strange one, he compares to an x-ray. Still the same person, right? Whether it's a formal portrait or a series of snapshots or a movie or documentary or an x-ray, you're seeing something from a totally different way. Maybe you wouldn't even recognize it's the same person, but it is. And Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John sort of play themselves out that way. Matthew's my favorite, not because I like formal portraits, I don't think, but probably just because I spent more time in it than the rest, that Matthew means a lot to me. There's a guy named Warren Carter, who's another theologian, and if you just like good commentaries, he's my favorite on Matthew. It's called Matthew in the Margins. And when Carter describes Matthew, he talks of moving through six different... I'm going to get to technology, by the way. He talks about going through six different movements, I guess. And just for your quick way of understanding the entire gospel, the first movement, he says, are the first four chapters, basically. And in the first four chapters, Jesus is established as God's saving presence in the world. If you happen to be looking at your Bible there, I'm not going to quiz anybody. I told David last night, the problem with a small room is I'm fine, but you guys are more nervous that I'm not calling you, right? I'm not going to, so feel free to talk along the way. But if you're looking through Matthew, you see it begins with a genealogy. Remember the formal portrait? The son of the son of the son of it goes through, and he throws in some people that you wouldn't expect, like Rahab and Tamar and Oh, these are in the line of Jesus. Matthew's making a point, okay? But he's showing that Jesus is in line with God. The story of the birth. A father named Joseph who escapes to Egypt, right? People get this point whenever they're reading about the story of Jesus, that, oh, this is the story of God. The story of a king that tries to kill all the babies. Oh, we've heard that story, right? Of a Pharaoh that tried to kill all the babies. And who was saved? Oh, it was Moses. And was Moses important? Yeah. He led the people. He was the source of salvation for a people in bondage. And Jesus is identified in that story. He comes up out of Egypt. He goes out, we're going to talk, into the desert to be tempted for 40 days, reminiscent of 40 years of wandering, of testing, right? He's baptized in the Jordan, which was the metaphor for crossing over into a promised land. John the Baptist. All those chapters establish Jesus as something that God is doing in this world. Then the second movement is chapter 5 through 10, basically. When Jesus, it's not just Jesus as a concept, but now Jesus is teaching and acting and walking among the people. And you remember, I'm sure, the Sermon on the Mount, chapters 5, 6, and 7. Jesus lays out, here is what you need to know. And in chapters 8, 9, and 10, he goes out and begins to do what he just said. Chapters 5 through 10. I have to point out, because it's one of my favorites, the Beatitudes begins that Sermon on the Mount. When Jesus begins speaking and teaching, he begins with the Beatitudes. And I've learned over the years, those Beatitudes, if you looked at it in Greek, which I can't read Greek, but I read people that read Greek, that they say that you can see a pattern there of two different sets of four. That they're the same number of words in the first set of four, the second set of four. It begins and ends with similar terminology. In the first set of four outlines, it seems, it's what my belief is, the sort of people that God is coming to save. The people who are poor, says poor in spirit. The people who are crying. The people who are meek, and we've always heard these sermons about how you should be meek, but it seems that word is the people who are voiceless. And then the people who hunger and thirst for justice or righteousness. So these poor, crying, beaten down, hungry people, Jesus is like, I've got good news for them. And then the second set of four are the people who are bringing the good news. The people who are active in the kingdom, the peacemakers. Those who show mercy. Those who have pure hearts. Those who are going to get beaten up for the fact that they are standing up for the kingdom of God in this world. I'll revisit that in just a second. But in chapter 5, it begins with, we've got good news. And here are the sort of people. And then Jesus begins to extrapolate on that. What does it mean to show mercy and have a pure heart and be a peacemaker? Well, here's how it works in your marriage and in your comings and goings and how you feel about your enemies and how you pray and how you give. And that's what the rest of the sermon. And then he goes out and does it in that next section. Third section, beginning in chapter 11. You begin to notice how people react to Jesus. So Jesus is God's saving presence. Here's what he teaches. Here's what he does. Here's what people think of. And from chapter 11 through the middle of chapter 16, people begin to ask, I'll say it this way. The wrong people are the good people. And vice versa. The Pharisees and the Sadducees and the teachers of the law and the people that are supposed to be the leaders, they don't react well to Jesus. And those who are the outsiders, the marginalized, those who seem to have been punished by God, they're the ones who seem to be recognized by faith. And in the middle of chapter 16, I think it's the key moment in all of Matthew, because Jesus says, to conclude that section, he says, who do people say that I am? That's that whole section, right? People are saying a lot of things. Who do people say that I am? And they answer him, and they say, well, some people say this, some people say that, some people say something else. And then Jesus says, well, what about you? Who do you say that I am? And it's Simon Peter, right, that speaks up with the great confession. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus says, yes, Simon, the son of John, yeah, and on this confession I will build my church, and the gates of hell won't prevail against it. And then it says Jesus began to teach them about the cross, which is the next section. It says, from that moment on, Jesus began to say, I need to go, and I need to suffer, I need to die. And does anybody remember what happens or who speaks up? I mean, this is an easy one because you don't even have to know, right? Who do you think speaks up every time there's a lull, right? Peter always speaks up, right? And he just spoke up and said, I believe you're the Christ. And Jesus said, that's amazing, right? Great way to go. And then Peter speaks up when Jesus says, now I'm going to have to go suffer. And what does Peter say? Never. This should never happen to you. And Jesus calls him Satan, right? Right after he makes a great confession, like 2 seconds later, he's gone from being, I'm going to build my church on you and this rock, right? Now he's saying, you're Satan and get behind me. I don't want to see you right now. And from that time on, Jesus, in this fourth section of Matthew, begins to teach them what it's going to look like to be the people that live in the way of the cross. Had to bring that up, right? This whole series, this whole lectures is about being fashioned in the way of the cross. From chapter 16 through chapter 20, he talks about marriages again. He talks about how often you forgive your brothers and your sisters. Here's what it looks like to be a people that are going to live in the way of the cross. Fifth section, from 21 through 27, is the entrance into Jerusalem. It's the overturning the money changers' place in the temple courtyard. It's going and being anointed by this woman that people are wondering, what is she doing anointing him? And then there's the betrayal by Judas and the story of the death and the burial, 21 through 27. In the middle of that section, I want you to know, because I have to tie it together, at the end of chapter 25, Jesus tells the story of the sheep and the goats. And why I want to tell you that is, if you have a red letter Bible, which I don't know if we use anything but our phones anymore, I'm getting to technology, I promise.
It's got red letters.
It's got red letters, even that, yeah. And the end of chapter 25 is the last big red letter section. So the first big red letter section was the Beatitudes in the Sermon on the Mount. And the first words out of Jesus' mouth are, here are the people that are going to have good news preached to them. And here are the sort of people that are going to do it. And you fast forward 20 chapters to the end of chapter 25, and you remember the story of the sheep and the goats? There are the poor and the blind and the hungry, the thirsty, those without clothes, those who need a place to stay. All of those people are being served by people who are so pure in heart, they don't even know that they're doing it for Jesus. And they're showing mercy on others. And then Jesus goes and he dies. And the last movement, of course, is in chapter 28, whenever Jesus raises from the grave and leaves his great commission at the end to go out into all the world and be that to others. Matthew chapter 4 is what I want to read to you. And I am learning how to juggle reading glasses. This is new to me. Let me read the passage that I want us to spend some time with and relate it to our topic. Chapter 4, verse 1. Then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And he fasted 40 days and 40 nights, and afterward he was hungry. And the tempter came and said to him, if you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread. But he answered, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Then the devil took him to the holy city and set him on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will give his angels charge of you, and on their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone. Jesus said to him, again it is written, you shall not tempt the Lord your God. Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them. And he said to him, all these I will give you if you will fall down and worship me. And then Jesus said to him, be gone, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. Then the devil left him, and behold, angels came and ministered to him. New story to anybody? Of course not, right? Let me tell you how I read that story for most of my life. Was, wow, that must have been tough for Jesus. Okay? And here's why I thought that. Because first of all, the temptation, number one, was turn rocks into bread. And I don't know about you, but I have never been so tempted to do that because I can't do that, right? It's not a real temptation to me. And I thought, if I was hungry, maybe so, but I'm unable to do that. So that must have been hard for Jesus. And so I'm trying to get into Jesus's mind to understand, but it didn't really appeal to me. For the second one, different story. I know how I feel about this one. He was taken up at the top of the temple and said, why don't you jump and let the angels catch you? This will never tempt me in my entire life to jump off of anything tall, right? I am about 6'3"-ish. That's plenty for me. I don't like going up any higher than that where I can fall. I get nervous. And so I thought, okay, maybe it was tempting for Jesus, but not so much for me. Now, the third one, you can have everything in the world at your control. Okay, that's something that could be interesting to me. But even that, I've got to tell you, what was the stipulation?
Worship
Satan, right? Be a Satan worshiper and you'll get everything in the world. And it just was pounded into my head enough that that was icky thing to do, to worship Satan. And that seemed like a bad deal. Like I would say, you know, I will give you $1 billion, but you have to be a Satan worshiper. Okay. You had me till the Satan worshiper part, right? And that's, okay, maybe I'll get by with something else. So in other words, I've read this throughout the years and I've heard it as very important, and that Jesus needed to survive these temptations, and that Jesus actually could have done all of these things, but he's, and so I dissected it, but it didn't really relate to me as much as it does now. And here's what I propose to you, what I believe now, is that those temptations aren't temptations just to Jesus, that those are representative of the human temptation. That when, Paul says later, Jesus was tempted in every way that we were, hang with me on that word way, yet was without sin. I remember thinking, wait a second, he wasn't married, although I've never been tempted when we were married. It's totally great. But I'm like, he was never married, so how would he be tempted by something that a married person might be tempted by, right? I'm assuming if I was female that I'd be thinking, okay, there are probably some different sort of things that I thought about, but in every way that we were. And I believe now that what is outlined here in these three temptations are temptations of way. Okay? I'm going to read a bit in just a second. Eugene Peterson, if you've ever read the book, it's old now, The Jesus Way, which was his third in a trilogy that he wrote. He talks about these temptations as temptations of way. What Peterson claims is that Satan concedes the end. That Satan doesn't approach Jesus saying, I think I might get him so that I win in the end. That Satan recognizes that his way is ultimately hopeless and that his temptation was not about ultimate victory, that's conceded, but on the way that Jesus would go about this path. Let's talk about it for just a second. What's another way of thinking about that first temptation than just literal stones into bread that Jesus could do and I can't do? What's the temptation? Why is Jesus tempted by that?
He was hungry,
right? And 40 days, I don't know. I don't understand how you can do that. It's a topic for another class, but whatever. He was really hungry, right? And he could have eaten just like that, is what Satan said. And Jesus didn't. Okay? What's another way to think about that other than just he was hungry and so we have temptations about food?
Physical,
exactly. This is a physical need? Yes.
Power?
The power over your circumstances?
No, the power that Jesus knew that he had, that he could create a rock into a bread.
And yet he practiced self-restraint. And yet Jesus didn't subscribe to a my needs come first way of understanding things. It wasn't a self-gratification way that Jesus chose, but a way, as Brother Haygood spoke last night, of that kenosis, of that self-denial, self-emptying, right? Now, in our world today, I can't imagine that there would be any problem with self-gratification, right, as a way of life. Or instant gratification, which is another way to look at that too, right? That it was, when was he going to get to eat? Right now. He ate later, right? But this idea of instant gratification, this me first, my ways win, that's one way. We could talk about this a while, and if we have time, maybe we will, but we could think of a zillion examples, right? And I'm previewing technology, I promise I'm getting there, right? Isn't there something appealing about being able to talk to someone right now and I want to talk to them? Being able to get my information now and not having to wait, of there not having to be any awkward silences, of there not having to suffer in any way whenever you want something. Technology is just one of a lot of ways, of course, in which we see that. The second one is a little more intriguing, I think. Jump off the temple, right? Again, the one that I thought, this is not going to be a problem of mine. Peterson suggests is this is a way of impressing people. Peterson says, and it's interesting, it's impressive that Jesus performed miracles, right? What's more impressive is how few he chose to perform and how often he said, shh, don't tell anybody about this. But this second way is Satan saying, you know what? Here's a way. If you jump off the temple and angels swooped in, I think they're going to be pretty impressed with you, right? And Jesus chose a different place of birth and a different sort of childhood and a different approach to ministry than anyone else would have thought. So the second way is a way of dazzling people, of entertaining people, of impressing people. And I work at an institution of higher education where we try to train people how to have really good-looking resumes, right? Because you need to impress. Where we have departments of public relations and advertising, and I'm not saying any of those are inherently evil. I'm just saying that is a way that we're used to living. Every way that I'm trying to outline here are the human ways. I mean, this is just who we are. We want satisfaction, number one. We want to be impressive, number two. And then the third one. How would you characterize that? I'll give you all of this. Power. Yeah. Control. Get your way. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but if he chooses that way, Jesus doesn't die, right? Because he dies at the hands of the authorities. He dies because they follow their procedures to the end. And if Jesus is their king, literally their king, you remember now the crazy metaphor of what's happening here when Pilate puts above his head King of the Jews, right? To either make fun of the Jews or make fun of him or whatever, but like this really is the king, but boy, he sure doesn't look like one, does he? What's interesting is in Luke, and I don't like to be talking from one gospel and then quote another one while we're doing that, but in Luke, at the end of the story of the temptations, it said Satan left him. In Matthew, it says Satan left him at the end of the temptation. Some of you probably remember this from Bible verses gone by. But Luke adds an interesting phrase. Satan left him for a time. Some translations say until a more opportune time. This wasn't a one and done thing. This wasn't, we've had the temptations now and Jesus won and see you later, Satan. He's gone for a while and he comes back. I went through all of Matthew, and maybe I should apologize for taking so much time to do that, because in Matthew 16, in that key moment, what's Peter called again?
Satan.
And what's Peter tempting Jesus to do? Not go to the cross. He said he just made this great confession, and it's a pretty opportune time for Satan to come back in, right? This is his guy. He's won. This is the guy ready to fight for him. And he said, okay, I've got to go and suffer and die. And Peter said, never do you have to suffer and die. Guess who said that in Matthew chapter 4? Satan said, never do you have to suffer and die. And yet Jesus chose that way, right? Later, by the way, in Matthew chapter 26, Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane. And the language doesn't say so much, but we understand, given his grief and his needing people close by, that this is a tough moment. And it's dark in the woods because Satan is present again. And it's a pretty opportune time for Satan to be saying, you don't have to do this, right? Instant gratification. I don't have to suffer. Chapter 27, Jesus is on a cross. And what are the people doing below him? They're mocking him, and they're challenging him too. In what way? Come on down, right? Dive off the temple and they'll catch you. If you're really the Son of God, impress us. And I don't know about you. I won't tell the full story of when I broke my leg, shattered my leg right before we got married. So I was actually in a wheelchair at our wedding. It's a long story. It's entertaining, but I'll save it for another time. But I was in the hospital after I broke my leg really badly. And it was a series of misadventures, and I wasn't getting any real help, and I hadn't received any pain medication in 2 hours. And I remember a point where I thought in my mind, if someone came in and said, we will chop your leg off and you won't hurt anymore, they wouldn't have had to ask twice, right? There's a certain point of pain when you're like, I don't care anymore. And Jesus, please understand, Matthew 27, the pain that he's going through, and there's Satan saying, jump off the temple, turn stones to bread, rule the world. All of those options are there at his disposal. And Jesus says, no. And in Matthew 28, I'm really going to test your Bible verse knowledge here. The Great Commission at the end, right before Jesus says, go into all the world, he says one other phrase. Says they came to Jesus, and Jesus said to them, and he says something, and then he says, go to or teach all nations. Anybody? What's that? I don't think so. What? All authority. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. You can't miss this, right? If I never get around to technology, you can't miss this. That at the beginning, Satan says in chapter 4, I'll give you all authority on earth. And Jesus says no and pursues a different way. And after he wins on the cross with a different way, he says, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. So that Jesus' way trumps Satan's way. I'm sorry, we can't use that word anymore. I'm sorry, the word trump. I say it more often than I've ever noticed before. But anyway. Because then I'll lose everyone. The question that's interesting is this. I'm going to read just a little bit for Peterson here. Is what way did he choose? Right? So if these are the human ways, and the way is self-gratification, impress others, control, get your own way, then what was the way Jesus chose? And it would take us a long time to work our way through just thinking through chapter 5 of Matthew through 28 of what all he did. Let me just read just a tiny bit here from Peterson. Whoops, one page ahead. He says this. Each of the devil's temptations has to do with the way that Jesus is the way he will go about his work. I'll skip down. No, I'll be repeating myself. But he says, will he reduce and depersonalize the way by imposing his will on the rocks, using them to provide for human needs? First, taking care of himself, and then feeding a lot of people. Will he put on a circus spectacular, demonstrating the miraculous, ever-present providence of God to the people on the street, but never dealing with them as persons? Will he rule the world by means of a faceless bureaucracy, efficiently enacting justice and prosperity without getting his hands dirty? Jesus said no to each one in turn. Jesus gave a definitive, scripture-backed no to each temptation. And why? Listen. Because in each case, it would have been an impersonal way, a way abstracted from relationships, a way disengaged from love, a way imposed from the outside. It would have been a way ripped out of the comprehensive story of salvation and therefore ripped out of participation in people's lives. Whatever the way of Jesus means, bullying force is not a part of it. It is certainly not what takes place when a fuse of dynamite is lit. The way of Jesus is always exercised in personal ways, creating and saving and blessing. It is never an impersonal interference from the outside. I'll skip down to one other thing. We cannot do the Lord's work in the devil's ways. The devil has great ideas, brilliant ideas, but every time that we embrace ways other than the ways of Jesus, try to manipulate people or events in ways that short-circuit personal relationships and intimacies, we're doing the devil's work. Vigilance is required,
It has always been required. It is required still in this America where doing good work in impersonal ways is epidemic. Peterson argues, and you can take it or leave it, that the way Jesus chose, instead of those ways, that all of those ways are impersonal ways. Self, impress, power, but Jesus chose a way of relationship. And the word love that we know is right in the center of everything is a word that doesn't work well when it's self first, or when it's showing off, or when it's controlling your power. But that Jesus' way was a way of relationship, and watch him walk, right? He goes through. Couldn't he have organized better? I'm an efficiency guy. Dave, I know you are too. And I like to make things happen, right? And I like to be organized and have, you know, good meetings. And Jesus doesn't seem as organized as I want him to be. He's also not as stressed out as I am, but he seems to walk through the earth, and he's not that busy to notice somebody on the side of the road and have time for them. That's the way that Jesus chooses to go about doing his work. Hebrews 12, if I remember this correctly, after Hebrews 11, this big story, all the stories of faith, what does it ask us to do? In view of God's witness, of this great cloud of witnesses, to throw off everything that entangles and the sin that hinders and the sin that entangles. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning his shame, and sat down on the right hand of God. The idea of the Hebrew writer is, you may not see everything come like you want, but keep your eyes on Jesus because he saw beyond. We need to follow in his way, not be distracted. Okay, so here we are. We have time left. I promised you I would get to some. Oh, we don't have much time left. I'll move fast. Jacques Ellul was a French sociologist, lawyer, theologian. In 1954, mind you, he wrote this book, The Technological Society. Stick with me here. 1954. He wrote it in French. Thankfully, people can translate into English because I would have nothing there. Now, you see like this great technology like a cassette player or something, right? And so in Ellul's mind, he didn't even know what he was even thinking about when he thought about technology. He called it technique instead of technology. But really, it's efficiency. It's finding better ways to do things through machines or whatever, right? And what he predicted in 1954 as a sociologist is that technique or technology would be presented to the world as this will make your life better. This is going to serve you. And yet, it would become the Lord of humanity. And that we would do its bidding. And I'm telling you right now, that this is killing me to be here because I've got emails piling up right now at work because I'm supposed to be at work right now. And it's bugging me, right? And I don't ever stop working now. In the early to mid-90s, I remember listening to a radio broadcast, and it said, the personal computer is about to take over the country, right? And this is so awesome. Not just the personal computer, the computer. And the computer is going to change our lives in a good way. And here's how it's going to change our lives. I'll remember this till the day I die. 40-hour work week, 10 years, it's going to be a 30-hour work week. Why? They weren't stupid. It made perfect sense. Because what you're doing now can be done so much better. And so in a little while, you'll be able to have all this free time to yourself. Isn't that great? And guess what we did? We said, sign us up for that. And how has that worked for us? And we never stop working now. In fact, if you want to make somebody's life end, take their phone away from them, right? And they're like, I don't know how to work. I don't know. I've got to. Anybody gone on a vacation and truly rested? I hope some of you have. The rest of us are working on that, right? Because it's hard to do that because you can work all the time. I'll tell you this. Going on a vacation, even if you put your phone away the whole time, is terrifying, right? Because when you get back, you've got three times as much work to do than whenever you left. This is what technology has done for us. I don't have time to read them all, but I brought two articles. I was going to read part of them. One was recent edition, Harvard Business Review. A computer science professor from Georgetown University had a crazy proposal. He called it crazy. He says, eliminate work email. Nobody should have email at work. No al.sturgeon@pepperdine.edu, get rid of all of those. I told a story that in the early 1980s, IBM had this bright idea called EMAC, and they tried to introduce it in their workplace. And they found out that in a short amount of time, that people's lives were overwhelmed because they communicated far more than they had ever communicated in their lives. And he said, the only way we're going to get rid of this problem now is to bring it up by the roots. We can't tinker with it, come up with more technology to make it better, right? It's Lord. It's taking over what we do. Peterson says that technology is the means by which we live. One thing I didn't mention about Elul, and it's the most important part, is what his major premise is that technology becomes an ever-increasing quest to improve means for carelessly examined ends. That our means are getting better all the time. We can do things faster and better and more. But we never stop to think, well, where is that going? Okay. I will read just a tiny bit. Klaus Schwab, who looks really important, and he must be, because they had his picture in this on the back page of Time magazine earlier this year. He's the founder of the World Economic Forum. They're talking to him, and they ask him, what will be the big topic at your institute this year? He says, we're at the tipping point of a whole variety of interconnected technological breakthroughs, robots, drones, artificial intelligence, all of this. His last sentence is, no one is thinking about long-term consequences. And then they said, like what? And he said, if we do not want to be dominated by technology, we have to become a more human society. What leadership style, what capabilities do we need to master all these technologies? I believe we need to emphasize the human aspect in leadership as a counterweight to all of these technological advances. This is the last part I'll read. If you think about what a human being is, we exist because of brains, soul, heart. What we can replicate in a robot is the brain. But you never replicate the heart, which is passion, compassion, and the soul, which enables us to believe. The robot will never have the ability to believe in something. So perhaps we will, at the end of this revolution, possibly have a basis for a new human renaissance. Time magazine, this guy's really important. I don't know who he is, but he seems really important. Saying we're going to go even further than we've ever gone before, but you can never replace the heart and the soul. But we're going to sell it in the process if we're not careful. I meant to say this at the first, in pure lawyerly fashion, a qualifier to everything, and say, if you are expecting to come to someone and who says, I've got this all figured out, right? And here's how I live my life, be like me. You're in the wrong place, right? Because I am right in the midst of everyone else. I have almost 3,000 Facebook friends. I've got a blog that I maintain. I don't tweet very well, but I know how, and all of these things. And I'm in the middle of this thinking, where is the, why? And why don't I have time for the person that I bump into that just needs a few hours? A few hours. I've got too much work to do. Got too much to do. What I just want to propose to you is this reminder that our end, right, as N.T. Wright spoke about on Tuesday night, right, this heaven on earth. Jesus has all authority in heaven on earth, right? And that's our end. What's our way to that end? Our way is the way of Jesus. Whatever gets in our way, whatever replaces that way of Jesus, needs to go in some way, fashion, or form that I'm still trying to sort out. And what I do know is Romans 12 tells us, after 11 chapters of saying, here is what God did, his mercy. In chapter 12, it begins by saying, in view of God's mercy, present your bodies as what? Living sacrifices. The way of Jesus, which is your spiritual act of worship. Verse 2, and I'll finish with that. Do not be conformed to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may be able to test God's good, pleasing, perfect will, right? I'm still just trying to sort it all out. What I hoped to do today, and thank you, because I don't think you meant to do that, but that tells me, I think it's a good thing, that our way has got to be the way of Jesus. And Peterson says technology is our way today. And that can't be for followers of Christ. So thank you for letting me talk at you for a little while, and I appreciate you showing up and making me not talk to us empty room.